Lofsa gave, at some point he decided that he didn't want to be in public service anymore. And he decided he was going to leave the kingdom or the dukedom or, you know, whatever. These names are kind of fluid in a lot of ways, these titles. And he was walking, or, you know, the classic iconographic Lao Tzu is this old man riding an ox. So he's just this old guy. It's just this old guy who's like, you know, screw you, I'm going home. I'm tired of all this BS, and so I'm going to get out of here. And as he's getting ready to leave the kingdom, you know, kingdoms and dukedoms and principalities, they often have border guards. Did y'all know that? I know we don't have such things. Just kidding. They often have border guards, and the border guards, could you imagine this? You know, some guy who's become famous or infamous, a Socratic or a Laozian figure, you know, maybe when I'm 95 years old, could you imagine I've decided I'm going to just leave the United States and some border guard stop? No, you can't leave until you write down everything you know or all your wisdom. And I'm like, well, if you got a piece of paper. And Lao Tzu is not too much different. And so he's like, so Lao Tzu is trying to leave the country, and the border guard's like, I won't let you leave until you write your wisdom down. This is the myth, right? Because probably this is a conglomeration of stories and poems that are put together and then redacted by somebody in the around 300 BCE. But anyway, so Lao Tzu supposedly in the story is trying to get out. The border guard won't let him, and so he sets down. He writes a book that's 5,000 characters long. Of course, you know in Chinese is a pictogrammic, right? So you can actually say quite a bit by the right combination of those symbols. But still, at the same time, think about that. 5,000 characters. There's only 81 poems inside the Tao Te Ching. Right? 5,000 characters to say all of this stuff that he says. That's also one of the reasons why it's a little paradoxical at times. And it's also an aspect of the text, if you could read the Chinese. And I'm not making any claims to being able to read Chinese. These things are pointed out to me by my Chinese scholar friends. And the gentleman that my brother who I worked on creating the right way of translating the text into English, something that would be possibly simple, gather the simplicity of what are there in the poems. But there's, you know, there's these kind of interesting, it's not just conjunctions and paradoxical words and phrases, right? It's like the pictograms themselves, if you kind of like meditate on them, there, it's like you got two opposing or counterposing, like they're contrapuntal pictograms next to each other sometimes, right? Saying do not do. And that's the other issue of it, is like if the text actually was completely transliterated, and in all actuality our translation tried our best to mostly transliterate and not get too clever, right? That if the text is mostly transliterated, it's very sparse. It's very sparse. And sometimes every now and then you'll run across things when you're reading it that are, a little socioculturally specific, so they don't quite makes sense right off the bat, you know. Anyway, so reading the text, the different translations you can get a hold of, and our translation doesn't fully escape this, right? I'm an existential phenomenologist. I'm an existential philosopher. The text really, in a lot of ways, bears the imprint of having been read by an existentialist. As much as we tried not to add stuff to it. Read by somebody who's super Christian, you know, translated by somebody who's super Christian, it begins to take on a very kind of like Christian tone. Read by someone who's super materialistic, you know, not in the bad way, but they're, you know, oriented on matter, material world, or reality, or nature. It begins to take on that tone. Because that's, it requires a great deal of interpretation, even for a Chinese person to read it. And it actually has to be, just like we have to translate Beowulf, or we have to translate the Canterbury Tales into an English that's doesn't make you stumble when you're trying to read it, you know? I mean, you could read the Canterbury Tales in Middle English, but there'd still be some stuff where you wouldn't know what it is. Well, just in the same kind of way, despite the fact that some of these pictograms have just merely evolved only a little bit over the course of 2,000 years, you know, these things still have to be kind of cleaned up and given some notes and things for contemporary Chinese people to read it. The interesting aspect about this is, to me, it's one of the most influential books of the last 150 years worldwide for many reasons, and it's one of the most influential books, like three most influential books in the history of Chinese, of the Chinese people, right? And I am not a Chinese scholar by any way, shape, or form of the imagination, but five Chinese people have come from China and studied Taoism with me, have studied the Tao teachings with me, because they don't do it over there anymore. Right? I mean, people at large might do it, but their academics are all basically being taught, you know, a fairly, you know, scientific materialism, right? And they don't expend a lot of energy going over these kinds of concepts and things. And so, oddly enough, one of the reasons that this translation even was accomplished is that one of those people who came over became very interested in going through the text carefully. And so over the course of a year, first he and I started reading it poem by poem. And then we got about 12 poems into it, or maybe 15 poems into it. So we'd only get together and talk about two poems a day. So we got about 15 poems, 16 poems into it. And we were like, and he was like, you know, brother, we might as well translate this because that's what we're doing. And I said, you know, brother, we might as well translate this because that's what we're doing. So we ended up in harmony, and we started working on it, and we were both in a really nice position where we had time to work on it. And so, you know, we spent the next year getting together once a week and going over three poems. And then the last couple of weeks he was here, the last month he was here, we got together and went back over the poems, made sure that we had pretty good notes that would explain parts and things. So, and then the last day he was leaving, I told him, I said, you know, Wenlong, it's good that I didn't let you leave before we got this book done. And he laughed, and he hugged me, and then he got on the airplane. So let's talk a little more then about Taoism, the Tao teachings. Actually, I was thinking about that. Let me switch over here now, too. You know, yesterday, in trying to get rid of the isms, let me see now. I'm trying to close all my crazy, subversive anarchistic stuff before y'all see it. So, no, just kidding. Okay. So we talked yesterday in the last lecture portion. We were going over these ideas, and I was talking about, and Ivan reminded me that I was trying to get rid of the isms part of stuff. And when the Buddha Dharma came to China, I told you yesterday, the vocabulary they drew from to translate Buddha Dharma concepts into Chinese was mostly from the teachings of the Tao philosophers. And actually, the word they translated Dharma as was Tao. So I think you can also say here, if you look at these notions, you have the Hindu Dharma, the Jain Dharma, the Buddha Dharma, the Confucian Tao, and the Tao Tao. Or you could say the Lao Tzu Tao. I suppose you could do that if you wanted to. This symbol, of course, has become super present in iconography. I don't know. It's probably in the top 10 things that people get tattooed on their bodies for the rest of their lives. What does it look like when you look at it? Koi. Yeah, it's two fish, actually, right? Who each represent different dynamic processes. That's one thing to keep in mind when you look at this particular symbol, is that it's a symbol attempting to capture a dynamic process, a tension. Right? A back and forth tension. It flows. If you really meditate on it, it begins to move. You see the tension, you see the movement, right? I think when you're thinking about it, you know, what's also kind of interesting, of course, is the way that it breaks up into the two aspects of the dynamic. I guess one way that my colleague J. Baird Callicott, who I've worked with a lot of Greek philosophy, would describe this is he would call it a dynamic equilibrium. So this dynamic equilibrium here, as you look at it, the first thing that ever caught my eye were the eyes of the koi, or were the dots, right? It's like, you know, it's not a pure, in one sense, pure black and white, two different, separate things, right? It's actually the understanding of how these two processional energies relate to each other in such a way that that one cannot dominate the other. So you don't get a pure dualism. Right? It's always going to be You know, it's actually not yin and yang. This is actually one of the places where you can kind of see what happens when Westerners first start getting a hold of something. So, first place people start talking about this in the West, they talk about yin and yang. Okay. It's not, see, here's the, we call this a coordinating conjunction. Okay. We call this a coordinating conjunction in English. There are a few coordinating conjunctions. What are the coordinating conjunctions in English? And, or, but,
yet,
so,
don't say for?
No, that's a subordinate. And, or, but, yet, so. See, is there another one?
The other one's an
N.
I think it's not.
Oh, no. That would just be, not is just nor.
Yeah.
So anyway, it first starts being talked about. It's talked about yin and yang. So they stick this coordinating conjunction in it, right? But in reality, it's not yin and yang. It's yin yang. Which means yin and yang, yin or yang, yin but yang, yin yet yang, yin so yang, yang so yang, yang so yin, yang, yang yet yin, yang but yin, yang or yin, yang and yin. This actually plays into our tendency to make things dualistic. And I've always thought this is an important... just keep carrying my affectation around with me. I've always thought that this is an important concept for people to kind of get a hold of. What is dualism? What is dualism? We got the ism, so we know that's shorthand for reduced to. Okay, so yeah, so what does it literally mean then to reduce to two? Okay. Reduce to two. All right. Our thinking, Western thinking is very much unfortunately guided by dualism. Right? Yes and no. Black and white. Good and evil. And the problem of the dualism is, what do you think the problem of the dualism would be? Biggest problem of the dualism. One, there's no gray area. That's a big problem. There's another problem. What's another problem of dualism?
The fact that it divides things.
The division. What does the division do? What does the division allow for you to possibly do?
It puts things in contrast. It allows separation.
It allows the separation. And if you can separate it, then what can you do?
You can choose between.
If you choose between, what will you usually end up doing? Invalidating the other one, right? so that it minimalizes the gray. Of course, obviously, even this language is a little loaded because it comes from what happens when you blend these two separated colors. You minimalize the gray, and you prefer one over the other. Because I lied to you a minute ago. By the way, I'm not talking about anything that I had actually prepared to talk about. I lied to you a minute ago. This is not how people in the West began to talk about this concept, to write about it. They did not begin to write about it as yin and yang. I lied. I'm a liar. I'm evil. From looking at this, yin and yang, it's called yin yang. Yin is the dark, receptive female aspect of qi. Yang is the bright, assertive male aspect of qi. So given your knowledge of Western history, how do you think they originally wrote about it? They called it yang and yin because in Western dualism, the male is to be preferred and chosen over the female. So the masculine was put before the feminine. By the way, in Chinese, you read from right to left. So that's the reason why it's called yin yang. In case, see, even things like the way that we read changes your view of things. So you're probably thinking, well, doesn't it make sense to call it yin, yang yin? Because the, you know, it's on the left side and you read from left to right. No, you don't. You read from right to left. What are you, barbarians? So, in dualism, we prefer, we minimalize the gray area, right? And one of the ways we minimalize the gray area is this very important point. We prefer one side over the other side. And that's important because despite the fact that this is a strong, literally a strong conjunction, literally a strong joining together, and, right? And it's a strong joining together. And in fact, just by flipping it and doing this yang and yin thing, they actually tip their hand that they prefer the male. They also tip their hand that they mean this to be a weak conjunction or a disjunction. And in logic, which of these symbols, which of these words stands for the disjoining? That says that they can be taken to disjoin here would be to break apart, to say that they can be broken apart.
Or.
So that in reality, by flipping it, utilizing the dualistic preference of the male over the female, they've weakened this and they've said what they really mean by this is yang or yin. So you can learn a lot about the history of your own intellectual environment by looking at how people 100 or 200 years ago had a reception to other people's ways of thinking, right? Well, and why I think this is very important is to get you to the place where you begin to make a little more sense of. It's very much the case that in all philosophy, that tends towards a certain kind of sacredness, or in all philosophy that tends toward, even all philosophy tends towards a certain kind of scientific thinking, the duel plays a role, right? It's very important. There be, you know, look at this machinery that we've got working in here. This is yes and no machinery, right? Zeros and ones. Actually, it's no and yes machinery. Shows the dominance of that Phallic symbol, right? When we say 0, 1, and then we don't say no, yes, but we say yes, no. But then even there, right, it's like no to the feminine, yes to the masculine, yay. So there are these duals, or these twos. The better word to think about these is dyad. It's a fancy Greek word which means two. But it actually means that you can't have one without the other. So yin yang never appears. As a dynamic equilibrium, a dynamic equilibrium meaning all dyads or all dyadic structures or all, really all structures, because most structures aren't dyadic, it's mostly conceptual, all structures in nature occur and obtain and sustain through dynamic equilibrium. So what you would call sustainability, that would be authentic sustainability, would be this dynamic equilibrium. All this is incredibly important because you can think about it in terms of our own time, or you can think about it here in terms of the Taoist perspective, because this is really what Lao Tzu is talking about, right? We are not maintaining or sustaining dynamic equilibrium. The world is out of joint. The world is out of joint. And it's out of joint because human beings have disconnected themselves. Now, I'm not talking about us. I'm talking about, this is what Lao Tzu was saying he saw. It maps onto us without a whole lot of effort, right? But this concept of the dyad is very important because a dyadic conjunction or a dyadic expression, you actually only understand the sense of the other by its relation, right? Night, day, cold, hot. More than likely, it would go something more along these lines with most people. I'm not even sure whether good and bad should be in here anymore, to be honest. I think I've unfortunately crossed over into that realm. What are other dyads we can think of? Oh, no, yes. It's important. Black, white. Now, I want to remind you of that crazy etymology that I did for y'all, right? Back 2 or 3 weeks ago, where I was like, the etymology of the word black is white. Because it actually just meant no color. Right. contrast. So, the issue of dynamic equilibrium, this would be sort of a snapshot of dynamic equilibrium of sustainability, where the yin and yang are in proper relationship and balance with each other. The wu ji, the calm in the midst of the storm, stillness and movement. This is actually that one. That one little curve. The stillness and movement. It's not a boundary per se. Right? Because in all actuality, in the stillness and movement, where does yin stop and yang start? Well, right there. Come on. Looking at it then from that perspective of seeing the wuji, you actually are kind of getting the idea of where to be centered, right? Even to draw it, it's kind of hard, right? There's nothing outside of it. I love that sentence. There is nothing outside . What does that mean? I mean, you can kind of like also see from this why Buddhists would have resonated to the Tao when they got there. The Buddha Dharma would have resonated to the Tao when they got there, right? They would have been like, oh, these people already were on the right track. So, but think about this sentence. What is it? Ben, what does the sentence mean? There is nothing outside. Well, but yeah, but let's not you know, go like eager teenage boys for the girls' locker room, just directly into the interior. Let's stick with that for a little bit. There is nothing outside. It's kind of there, right? There is nothing outside. You're going to be like, Keith, you're just playing semantic games and I'm ready to like recollect my tuition payment. There is nothing outside. There is nothing outside. Right? There is always somewhere, something. And so it's always inside. It denotes an inside. So, if there is always something and somewhere, then to talk about it outside is to talk about nothing. There's nothing outside. This is the whole thing, right? The outer circle indicates that all things are made up of yin and yang. There's nothing outside of that. But that's not a negative statement. That's what I'm really trying to get you to grasp on this very early Wednesday morning for some people who are up late. I'm trying to get you to grasp that there's nothing outside of yin yang. But that's a positive statement, not a negative statement. Okay. And then you see, as we've already said, there's a little bit of yin and yang and a little bit of yang and yin, so that there's no absolutizing. Right? That germ, as we say, that germ or that rhizome of each in the other means they stay in their dyadic connection. They can't be forced apart. Right. Yeah.
So I was just noticing one. All the Eastern languages, like, you know, Chinese, maybe Chinese have, I don't know, but like Urdu or Persian or Arabic and all these languages, everything is either a male or a female. So
same thing in Chinese.
Mm-hmm. So is there, can be a link that this is related to how we speak those languages?
Yeah. No, that's because your experiences of English.
English
doesn't have it. But right. In English, these things don't exist. In the Romanic languages and even in German, things have a sex. They have a gender, excuse me. Yeah. Yeah. It happens in most languages. Why it doesn't happen in English, it's not so much that it doesn't happen in English, it's just that over time, the fact that we gave up on certain language structures that German keeps, like declensions and those kind of things, for whatever reason we did, the gendering of nouns is just fell away a few hundred years ago, but it's still there, in one sense, because it's hidden. It's very hidden. So you actually, until recently, and this is conscious. I think the other, you might say, is a kind of evolution of language. This sort of thing happens, and there are other languages in the world where this is also happening. But it happened. It's happening consciously now, where, in one sense, you know, we're trying to get away from the fact that hurricanes are women. Right, so we've stopped, you know, so we consciously made the decision we'll name some hurricanes after men so that it will stop this sort of like extra, because it seems like some kind of a bias, right, that these horrible destructive storms are female, and, you know, but we also, you know, most sailors still refer to their ships as women. You know, this actually hides the fact that these things were gendered before. Oh, sure. Language is always in a... Martin Heidegger once said a very profound thing, and it's not quite as confusing, although it's probably close to it, as me asking you to parse "there is nothing outside." He said, language... Sprache, language, is the house of being. So one way to think about that is as we participate in our myths of order, our narratives of orderly exchange, and we're building and organizing basically our dwelling places, those dwelling places become being for us, right? So this language is the house of being. It's how we order the world, right? And we order the world through the way that we speak. This is actually an important concept with Taoism, because Lao Tzu and the Taoists in many ways wanted us to quit doing that. They're like, you're too busy. Stop it. Stop. Stop. You're always coming up with new words. In the last 400 years, English has added like tens of thousands of words to its vocabulary. And it just, English is, in a lot of ways, a viral language, in the sense that it just like takes in whatever word that it needs, and it spreads around, and it's like, we need a new word, and you just come up with a new word, and not necessarily by, I mean, I like to come up with new words, I'm pretty good at it, but it's just something that you do. But this is a way that you show, in one sense, then your basic language, language you learn first, is your house, is the first house you have, right? So if your first language is Urdu, that's always going to be the base structure of your being, of your thinking, right? No matter how fluent you become in another language, right? But the interesting aspect, of course, is the more fluent you become in language and the more you learn about language, the more you can order your house and, put on new additions. And, you kind of like see how these things work. Well, the Taoists actually were very well aware, I think, of this. And so they were like, shut up and quit naming things. Right? Why are you always naming stuff? Stop, stop. Just let stuff do what it does. Don't. I mean, a good example actually of how you would see this in a Taoist story. Lao Tzu. Was sitting under a tree, and it was a real gnarly tree. It was like all gnarled up and bent, and it had a lot of different issues. And the guys came to him and they said, some guys came to him and said, you should tear this tree down because it's ugly. And another guy came to him and said, you should tear this tree down because it's barely even good for firewood. Put something better there and grow a tree that you can harvest for firewood or something. Get rid of this tree. It's just taking up space. And another person came along and, they said the tree's no good because it doesn't bear any fruit. And it's kind of an eyesore when I look out of my window. So maybe you might want to tear it. So everybody wanted to get rid of this tree. This tree's really ugly. I mean, it's kind of a butt ugly tree, obviously. He's already had three people stop by and tell him this tree should be done away with. And Lao Tzu doesn't say anything to any of these people. He just nods his head. And finally somebody shows up. All three of them show up together and they're like, are you not going to are you going to just keep this tree? And he's just sitting there and he's sitting under the tree. And he said, you say the tree's no good because it doesn't bear any fruit. You say the tree's no good because it's ugly when you look out of it at your window. You say the tree's no good because it... I say the tree's treeing. I mean, the tree's doing what it does. And on top of that, if I wanted to be mean, I'd say, I would accuse myself because I take shade beneath it. Right? But I don't want to say it's my shade tree because that's me naming it. I'm just letting it do what it does. You call it ugly. You call it fruitless. You call it, you give it all of these adjectives. You give it all of these names. You give it all of these judgments. But I'm just letting the tree do. So there, see, the sage saves the tree. Right? uh, he also, and I think this is a trick in our language, in the English language, but I think it's one to be thought of in conjunction with this. He also says that one of the biggest problems we have, in all reality, anybody could read him and you'd say, this dude's a libertarian anarchist. Probably not right. I mean, you're probably not wrong. It was a Freudian slip. You're probably not wrong. Too much. He says, there are too many damn laws. Right? And it's an interesting thing. Our word law comes from the word lex. The word lex actually comes from, is related to the word logos. But more importantly, the word lex is also the logos in, excuse me, and legain, which is another version of this in Greek. The word lex and legain, they're the root of the word legend. Laws are always legends. What do I mean when I say that, Amy? Laws are always legends. What do you think I mean when I say that? They're there, they're not really there, but they also kind of have a story that goes along with them, right? Yeah. I should boggle if at least half of you have not bought the legend about marijuana and why it should be illegal. I would be very surprised if more than half of you have bought that legend at this point. Right? All of our drug laws have behind them a series of legends about African-American men raping white women and about Hispanic people getting totally wildly nuts and, you know, not doing their jobs like they should. And, you know, of good white, I mean, this is all at the back of all this. It's just this bullshit dualistic morality of, you know, all the good white people who accidentally took one toke off of a marijuana cigarette, and they suddenly went on a wild rampage raping women and doing all the rest of the crap from like one toke. And it's like, where do you find that? What?
Didn't they originally make it illegal because white women, they said that white women would be with black men?
Cocaine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then also marijuana. And then, I mean, but huh? No, it was early 1900s. Up through about 1915 or so, drugs were actually treated as what they are, which is medicines, and it was all under the purview of doctors. Then they started doing all of this stuff. But the point, I'm getting a little bit far away. The point here is that all laws are backed up by legends. They actually are the instantiation of a legend. Legends are usually very verbose, and they're full of a lot of words, and you've built a whole house of understanding, and you're trying to put everybody into that house, and so it shouldn't be any surprise that by the time you get to 2016, in a society like the United States of America, in which we have over 4 million local, county, state, and federal laws, that we have an incredible amount of people who are criminals. Everybody in this room is a criminal waiting to be caught. If you haven't been caught yet, though, and some of you at this point now, I'm sure a few of you probably have a surly past. But the point is, here he says we have too many laws. Well, what do these laws do? The laws actually perform the function of trying to break things up and saying, this is to be preferred over that. This is to be preferred over that. And he actually makes the statement, and this is probably why some people would see him as a proto-anarchist. He actually makes the saying. He said, there are no criminals until there are laws. Right? And the best state is a state that says very little, does very little, And when it does do something, does it so quietly, nobody knows that it's kind of helping things along, and it doesn't make a lot of laws, it doesn't make a lot of legends, it doesn't make a lot of, doesn't name a bunch of stuff, right? It's going back into the nature. Now, in this regard, Lao Tzu actually is And he probably is close to being a contemporary of a wild, crazy Greek philosopher named Diogenes of Sinope, who was one of the first cynics. So cynics are a particular kind of philosopher who turns to nature. They're not what we call with a little c cynic, like, you know, oh yeah, you know, lesser two evils, blah, 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 blah. You know, it doesn't really matter who's elected president. That kind of cynicism. Now, cynic with a capital C, this actually is the same root as the root word of kennel, because this actually means the dogs. So they were called the dogs because they barked a lot at people because people were, you know, unnatural. People unnaturalized themselves. So the cynics in cynics and followers of the Tao in China actually kind of have in common the notion, if you want to know what to do, look to nature. So a common, you know, and don't over gild nature. Don't put tons of names on nature in the attempt to control it. Look and see what the natural process is, right? Look and see how nature runs in its natural flow, and then see how you step into that flow. And then you just go with that flow, and you don't, like, you know, stand there like a giant fat boulder in the middle of a stream, say, I'm going to build a house of legends here, right? So a really kind of interesting story, like, about Diogenes, but I think it's parallel to a Chinese follower of Tao. He's sitting there one day in the middle of the a nice little park area, and the kids are running around and playing, and this kid comes running up to a pond or to a little fountain, and the kid reaches his hand into the fountain and he gets out a thing of water and he throws it into his mouth. He just, right? He just starts drinking the water because he's thirsty. And Diogenes is just like, good God! I've wasted my life with a cup. And he throws his cup away. Right? Because, you know, why do you need a cup? Because you got your hand. And what do we call it when we do this? Cupping our hand. Right? So these are the kind of thing. That kind of thing is the sort of thing Lao Tzu would be like, you know, maybe Lao Tzu actually left China and he went to Greece. Who knows? You know, I don't think most people would want to live the way Diogenes did, and maybe not even the way that Lao Tzu did, right? I mean, he lived quietly under a broken or an ugly tree, and Diogenes used to live in a great big old wine vat that had been abandoned because he didn't see any reason to. A lot of the cynics of the ancient world would just live out in the open. You know, like the Gymnosophists or the people who've given up in India and they've just walked off into the forest, right? So there's a heavy influence across this axial age period of people kind of getting this idea, some more radically than others, that we appear to have gone a little too far in the direction of trying to make nature work the way we want to make it work, and of overemphasizing that we can control it, or that we can do better than it, or something like that. All right, let's take a 5-minute or so break.